Hello, everyone, and
hello,
welcome.
Everyone, and
hello,
welcome.
Everyone, and
hello,
welcome.
Everyone.
That was interesting. Are we good now? Okay, thanks. Thanks, Brian. Okay, so
it's situated.
Which is about this module. So about discovering Buddhism, how to meditate. Everything you need to know about this course is on there, hopefully. But if not, my email address is on there as well. So on the back, up at the top, contact info, there's program.db@kadampacenter.org is an email. You can send an email and I'm happy to answer it. If you have questions or concerns or can't find something, don't hesitate to let me know. So, that's just outside the door as well. When you exit class tonight, tonight's homework will be out on that table as well. So you can grab that on your way out as you exit. It's not there yet. For those of you who were here for the first module, The Mind and Its Potential, if you have completed the completion card and have done the essay that Robbie assigned, I'm happy to take those from you. I'm going to collect those and turn those into Robbie. So just catch me at some point during class and or after class, and I'm happy to take those from you and turn those into Robbie and get those signed. If you have any questions, again, just email me. And also, so a few logistics, be sure to silence cell phones. And after tonight's class, there is a discussion group, just an informal discussion group if you'd like to stay for that. The discussion group will be meeting just outside the doors here at the table. So feel free to stay for that. And that's pretty much held every, after class every Monday. Let's see here. What else? Oh yeah, this Saturday. This is good. This Saturday, Aaron Sloan, the last Discovering Buddhism assistant, will be leading a Lam Rim Saturday meditation from 9 to 3. So if you want to delve in a little bit deeper into the subject matter, please join her on Saturday. And if you go to the website, kadampa-center.org, look on the calendar, and there's more information there. And she would like everyone to register if possible if you think you're going to go, so we have an idea of how many to expect. And again, if you have questions for that, just shoot an email to that same email address, that program.db@kadampacenter.org that's on that information sheet. Let's see if I'm forgetting anything else. I think that's it, actually. Don, you ready to take it away? Okay. Sorry, Jason, I'm talking to you. Yes. That's right. Yes, yeah, so... Thank you, Don, for being here and giving us your time and expertise. So yes, everything that is offered here at the Kadampa Center is offered free of charge. We will take donations by just about any means. On the back of the informational sheet, the handout that's out back there, on the back of it are all the different ways that you can give and make donations. If you want a quick way, there's donation boxes you can drop cash or checks into it outside the Gampa door or in the lobby there. And then there's a variety of other ways on the back of the sheet down at the bottom to give as well. Luckily, teachers like Don and others give of their time and experience and expertise and enable these classes to happen free of charge. So it's an amazing opportunity that we have here at the Kadampa Center. All right. Anything else, Don? Any questions for me before we get started? Okay. All right. Thanks, everyone. So, yeah, no, I went over that. I think you were writing up there. So put it in the box or see all the other ways on the back of the About Discovering Buddhism sheet. There's text giving. You can mail it in. You can sign up online. All different ways. All right, I think we're good.
So welcome. My name is Don Brown, and I'm going to be the leader, the cheerleader of this class. Those of you who persevere, this is not, I don't think this is what anybody's expecting. This class is, I've taught the, in fact, I just found my notes from this class. The last time I taught it, I think, was probably about 10 years ago. But anyway, I just found my notes from it. And, you know, it's, but I want to do it differently. I want to do it in a way that's sort of more relevant. That might be, people might find relevant, and that people will, when they leave the class, they'll actually have some experience, not just information about this or that. So that's my goal. So we're going to start out with just, I think Robbie does prayers first or meditation. Prayers first, okay. I want to kind of keep some consistency. So what's going to happen? Let me give you a little idea of what's happening tonight. We have an hour and a half, a little bit less than that now. So we're going to start out, do the prayers. And these are just, does anybody, you know, prayers kind of, for some people, not everybody here is a Buddhist, probably. I'm going to guess none of you are, except maybe a few. How many people actually consider themselves committed to the Buddhist path? It's like their path, okay? How many people are just here as curiosity? Just want to see what, you know, whatever there is to see. Okay. How many people have a daily meditation practice? Okay. And how many people are getting any results from their daily meditation practice? I want to hear about those results later on, maybe. Yeah, so we're going to start out tonight with doing the prayers. Now, you can think of these prayers as, oh, they're trying to turn me into a Buddhist, but don't do that. Don't go there. We don't, honestly, I don't mean to sound flip, but I really have no interest in, I'm like Geshe-la, I have no interest in converting people to Buddhism. In fact, the Buddha, even the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist, I've heard. You know, he just taught the Dharma, and he was he just invited, you know, he was like an invitation. He said, just come and see for yourself. Check it out. See if it'll work. See if it helps your mind. If it does, great. If it doesn't, then you move on. So that was then. So we're going to read the prayers. We're going to do a few minutes of just mindfulness of the breath. I think many of you know how to do that, but it's not easy, is it? Not easy at all. And we'll do that, and then we're going to play the video, and then we're going to, after the video, if there are any questions, we'll answer those, and then we're going to, I'm going to play an audio from one of the, this book is published by Wisdom Publications. How many people are aware of, are familiar with this book? Yeah, it's like a quarter of a million copies. Probably the, I'm going to take a wild guess, it's the, maybe the best-selling book on mindfulness, meditation in the world. Maybe not, but close. It's done well. Let's put it that way. Don't worry, it'll be in the bookstore. They don't have it yet, but we'll have it. But I actually have it on, I've been listening to it in the car for the last month. I have an audio tape of it. By the way, I called Amazon and the audio crowd and got their permission to play the audio tape, so I'm not going to go to jail for doing that. I still might go, but it won't be because of that. Pardon? Yeah, not for that reason, exactly. So let's do the prayers. And I think Robbie, did Robbie do a good job of explaining? I can never tell what Robbie does and what Robbie didn't do. Oh, he did? Okay, good. What page are we on? Which page did we use?
34.
34, okay. So I'm going to explain it. So refuge, and we'll do refuge in bodhicitta, the four measurables. Did he do seven limb prayer too?
Yeah, okay. Robbie described taking refuge, four measurables, seven limb prayer.
Okay.
Oh, and the short mandala offering as well.
Oh, good. And these are ritualized prayers. And I mean, when I first learned them, I learned them in Tibetan, and didn't really know. I knew what they meant, but I didn't know what they. I didn't know the, you know, translation. But anyway, I'll just tell you, there are two things about the refuge and generating bodhicitta. I'll give you my version real quick. So I go for refuge until I'm enlightened. This is setting our goal, and it's also saying, and in the second line, to the Buddha, Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. So I go that line distinguishes Buddhists from non-Buddhists. So you might think, well, I'm not a Buddhist, but you can still say these lines. You don't go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha yet. You might eventually, but not now. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So that has to do with distinguishing the practices we do at Kadampa Center from the practices at, you know, other types of Buddhism, and we'll talk about other Buddhist meditation practices during the course. But you know, the emphasis here is on developing our good qualities and eliminating our defilements, our negativities, our afflictive mind states, poison, whatever you want to call it. To eliminate the negativity and enhance the positive qualities in order to be of better service to others. So the goal is to serve others. If there's the motivation, the goal is to benefit others. How do we do it? We purify our minds and we develop our qualities. So that's the main thing behind Mahayana Buddhism, which is the northern schools of Buddhism, Zen, and Zen that, you know, that goes through Chan Buddhism in China, and Vietnam is more Zen, and then Tibet, Nepal was Mahayana, same motivation, whereas the Theravada practice, which is really a lot of where what we're going to be doing is coming from, but it's subsumed within the Mahayana, but it's not emphasized the same way we're going to try to emphasize this here. The motivation is for individual liberation. It's like I am sick and tired of being sick and tired. I want to stop my own suffering, and I want to help others. Don't go there yet. Because if we can stop our own suffering, then we can help others. So it's really implied that compassion, you know, that once you get your act together and we stop the negative mind and our compassion begins to blossom, that we'll help others. But that's not the motivation from the get-go. So that's different. The practices from the Mahayana tradition, which is what Tibetan Buddhism is about, the motivation is to benefit all sentient beings. So we'll read these prayers and then talk about the other ones later. Okay, so we'll do refuge in bodhicitta three times. Oh, the other thing about refuge in bodhicitta, the reason you go for refuge, how many people who've done this class before remember why do you go for refuge? And why do you do this? Why do you go for refuge? Two things, two reasons, actually three. The first one is fear or dread, or you can, or just the being aware of how crazy our mind is, and the consequences of having a mind like that are going to be pretty bad. So we have some awareness of how, of what a mess we are, and that the future is not going to go well for us. All of us are going to get sick, get old, and die, and it's just, you can't, that's just part of life. So we have this sort of, it's the healthy dread, it's the dread that keeps us from running red lights and walking around without looking where we're going. And then the other part of it is confidence. Confidence that the Buddha and his teachings and the spiritual community can actually guide us. So there's the dread aspect of living the life with a mind that's completely out of control, and the confidence that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha can, the spiritual community and the enlightened beings and so forth, can guide us. And then the last one is compassion for ourselves and compassion for others. That's the motivation for doing this prayer. Okay? So we'll do this. We go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now, these are the four measurables. The first one has to do with immeasurable happiness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Those are the four. So may all, let's do it together. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And then the seven-limb prayer, this is a kind of a weird one, and if you don't, but you just read through it, it means, it's actually quite beautiful and powerful prayer, and it has a lot of interesting points in it. For example, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. Prostration is a way of paying homage, right? You see we do physical prostrations here sometimes. You can do mental prostrations. It's a way of paying homage. But it's an antidote to arrogance and pride. And it's impossible to learn if we are arrogant and inflated with pride. So this first line is an antidote to our arrogance and afflictive pride. There's other kinds of pride that are good. Alright, and then we'll go, I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence. Turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merit and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Then we'll do the mandala offering. And in the old days, to get the Dharma teachings, you had to want them, really make sacrifices to get the teachings. And so people would bring gold and all kinds of offerings to the teachers. And generally speaking, the teachers, the really qualified teachers, could care less about all this stuff. But this is a symbolic offering of the universe, like offering every... Lama Yeshe, my teacher, my first teacher, he and Lama Zopa, his picture's back there. And he used to say, just imagine, if you can't imagine offering up a universe of jewels and everything that's wonderful, just imagine offering everything in Crabtree Valley Mall, or, you know, all the good stuff, or South Point, whatever, where your favorite shopping center is. But just imagine in your mind that you're offering up all of these things. And there's a mudra that Robbie, I'm sure, did not teach you. But anyway, it's some, did he? Oh, good for him. Anyway, it symbolizes Mount Meru is right here in the center. And then these are the four continents. This is like Buddhist cosmology 101. It's not important. The important thing is that you imagine from your heart, you're willing to give up everything you have and more. It's that important that you get the teachings. You really want to get the teachings. So you do it with that kind of attitude. This ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with the Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. Imagine this as a Buddha feeling, offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Radnam Mandala Kamne Yatayami. And that supposedly means, I send forth this jewel mandala to the precious teachers. All right, so that's sets the tone for our meditation. So we're going to sit quietly for about 45 minutes. Just kidding. About maybe we'll go 10 minutes or so, give people a chance to settle down. Robbie's going over the meditation posture, right? 7-point posture. Did he do that? He did? Okay, well, just as a way of reviewing it. The key point of the posture, because some of you are sitting in chairs like me, is to keep your spine upright. You don't want to be leaning back in the chair. You want to be sitting upright, and then your chin slightly tucked in, your lips together, your tongue at the roof of your mouth, so you can channel saliva. So you don't have to swallow, because that can interrupt your concentration. I'm not a stickler on whether people open or close. Some people, the Tibetans typically will teach you to keep your eyes slightly open to let light in, because it keeps your mind a little brighter. But I think in the beginning, for us beginners, it might be distraction. So you figure out what works. You can have a soft gaze at the tip of your nose, or soft gaze in front of you, or you can just close your eyes. Then your hands, the fingers go like this, the left hand on the bottom, the right on the top. If you go to a Zen monastery, it's the other way, but Tibetans do it this way, with the thumbs touching, and that's just sitting comfortably in your lap. Your shoulders are down and back a little bit. You want your chest to open up. And then if you can sit and you want a little bit of, you know, ventilation here, because if you're sitting for long periods of time, you don't want to get too hot. And then if you can sit cross-legged, you know, there's so many different ways to do it, but Indian style or full lotus, half lotus, is the Burmese style. There's different versions of it, but just the point is to be still. You want to get in a comfortable posture and then not be wiggling and moving your body during the meditation, so that the work is done with your mind. So begin with taking a few deep, maybe three cleansing breaths. Deep, breathe deep in, and then exhale. Do it again. And exhale any tension and anxiety from today. And do it again. And exhale. And bring your awareness to your body. Your body's sitting. And then your awareness to the experience of your breath. And your body breathing. So for most of this class, we'll We'll try some different objects, but for most of this class, we're going to focus. We're going to use the breath as our focus. And in the beginning, we're going to try to, we're going to make an effort to develop this really concentrated state of mind, sometimes called shamatha, sometimes called calm abiding, concentration. We want to turn our mind into a laser, which is not easy, right? So we're going to focus on the breath. Now, whether you focus on the rising, a lot of people, by the way, there are many different objects besides the breath. If the breath doesn't appeal to you, then pick something else. I know one teacher I had, he used the, I think he had tinnitus or tinnitus, the ringing in his ears, that became the focus of his meditation. But if we use the breath, a lot of people use the sensation of the breath at the tip of the nose as you breathe out. And then there'll be a moment, a little pause at the end of expiration, and then you follow the breath in, and then a little pause, and then out like that. Could be the rising and falling of your abdomen, or the expansion of your chest, but just stay with the breathing, and in the beginning we'll just go out and in, out and in. Out and in, out and in. You can make a soft mental note, and we're not focusing on the sound, focusing on the sensation of breathing, but make the soft mental note out and in with each breath. In your mind, of course, if you can get past two or three breaths, that's pretty amazing. You usually get lost after one or two. Each time your mind goes away, what do? You gently bring the mind back to the experience of the breath, either at the nose or whatever place you're focusing on. Bring the mind back to the experience of breathing and start again. And by the way, that's like doing, if you're a weightlifter, I can tell a lot of people here are weightlifters. Every time you bring that your mind back, it's like doing a curl, or it's like strengthening the bicep of your mind, your mindfulness, just noticing that you've been distracted and bringing it back. So that's the key. Don't think you're a bad meditator because you could get lost for 15 minutes easily, but just once you notice you're gone, you bring it back. watch the entire breath, the entire exhalation. I'm going to pay attention to the entire exhalation. And then at the end of exhalation, how there's a little pause. And then as the breath turns around, it comes back in. And the entire inspiration. And then there's a small pause. You don't want to lose it for a second. You want to it's like a microscope, and you've been at the 10x, now you're going down to oil immersion. You know, you're going to get as close, put your mind as close as you can to the entire experience of breathing, the inhalation and the exhalation. Don't let your mind wander even for a moment. Bring your mind back again and again. As often as you need to. Now we're going to do the video, and if anything comes up, also when you get to the point where he's showing there's a tanka that shows up, and he's showing the different steps in developing calm abiding. I don't know if you can fast forward through that because not that helpful. But anyway, let's go ahead and get started. And part one. I need to turn off the lights in the back. Thank you. Buddhist center in Santa Cruz, San Francisco, right, just south of, about 45 minutes south of San Francisco. There's this part of this organization called Vajrapani, really beautiful, in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and if you ever get a chance.
Meditation is an essential step to develop on the path to enlightenment. Even in our daily lives, we can see that good concentration may accomplish much more work of better quality. Without a stable mind, we're like a candle sitting in the wind. We're vulnerable to negative influences and don't have much power to progress on the spiritual path. All Buddhist masters have relied on meditation to gain realizations. And if we look at the benefits, it's easy to see why. We feel more happy, balanced, and focused. And we experience a sense of inner peace. But meditation is much more than a way to relax and feel happy. It's a proven method for us to experience the true nature of reality, the true nature of our minds.
Can you hear in the back? Okay. It's a little bit warm in here, too. Can we cool? Maybe a little bit cooler?
When we are trying to dispel certain states of confusion or
Remember what he's saying. We'll talk about this. I went to see the Dalai Lama in L.A. one time, and I sat next to Gary Busey. Talk about an experience. I didn't learn much. This monk has done like one or two, like 3-year retreats, very long retreats on this practice.
By practicing, So that's why I think effort put into concentration into developing karma bhava is very important. And we can do that in everyday life. It doesn't mean necessarily to go into retreat to do that. And you just know how to go about it and how to, and you have to know how to integrate it into your everyday life. In order to develop karma bhava, there are certain conditions which help. So all these conditions we can gather in our everyday life. You don't need necessarily to go to a complete isolated place. It just means having little desire, be content with one's life situation, and have a little bit of peaceful environment. So even though one might have a family life, still we can wake up an earlier before everybody else and do some karma abiding then, or at the evening when everybody's at bed, or when the children are at school or something like that. One can find a place, a time in a day, if one wants it, for a peaceful meditation. So the first is to wishing to do the meditation, by seeing its advantage, then developing the determination, I'm going to do it after such amount of time, I'm not going to lose the object. And then is to develop the mindfulness of holding the object without losing it. And once you're able to do that, then you use introspection to check the quality of your concentration. That's to make it more precise. If you're prone to dullness, then you hold the object more intensely. If you have too much excitement, you relax and put the grip on your object. And like that, slowly you find a middle way, and you're able to hold on. So that's a little bit the process, how one goes about it. And by doing that, one goes through 9 stages. Just in brief, I will go a little bit over that. So when one starts meditating on karma bhava and sits down, okay, I'm going to meditate for 10 minutes.
We might as well watch it.
Holding food I make or watching the breath. So the first stage, what's the next? When you don't hardly ever find the object. During the whole session,
they call it the monkey mind. The wild elephant of the mind.
So just from time to time, actually you remember you're supposed to watch the breath. But your mind most of the time going all over the place. So this is the first stage of meditation. It's called placing the mind. It's actually trying to bring the mind onto the object in the first place. So the whole session is spent bringing the mind on the object, because most of the time it's away. So then the second stage is called placement with continuity. So there, one is able to bring the mind on the object and stay for a little while before losing it again. So there is a continuity. Before there was no continuity at all. You just bring it there, poof, it goes up, you bring it there, it goes up. Here, there is a continuity. Then the third stage is called touch-like placement. So there, at the third stage, you're able to stay on the object for quite a while. You stay on the object and from time to time you lose it. But then as soon as you lose it, you are aware that you're losing it and you're able to bring the mind back. And then the fourth stage is called close placement. So at the fourth stage, from the beginning to the end of your session, you don't lose the object at all. During the whole session, you are able to hold on to the object. There still is distraction and dullness, but one part of your mind never loses the object anymore. And then the fifth stage is called controlling. So because at the fourth level you are able to stay for the whole session on the object, you decide it. By familiarizing yourself with that, you reach a state of inner peace you never experienced before. Suddenly it's like your mind was always like boiling water, and suddenly the boiling water has subsided, and you find that your mind inside experience a kind of tranquility that you never had before, and you realize, wow, that's quite pleasant. The difference between the fifth and the fourth is that the fifth, there's no more gross laxity and gross excitement. So the gross aspect of this disturbance has subsided. You still have subtle dullness and subtle excitement, but not anymore the gross aspect. And then the sixth is called pacifying. It's very difficult to recognize because the object is there, it's stable, and it's clear. What is missing is the intensity of holding onto the object. So in general, when one reaches that sixth, it's better to lean towards the side of subtle excitement than to lean towards the side of subtle laxity. Because subtle excitement is easy to recognize. At the seventh stage, you can stay on the object.
By the way, we don't have to worry too much about this, having to deal with this. But it's nice to see that these people have actually done this.
The excitement and nerves is not so strong anymore. It doesn't happen often. And even if it arrives, you just need to poof. And the thought is stopped. The emotion is stopped. It's a process from going from your ordinary mind, which has this thought and things like that, to go into your mind of calm abiding. So it's like entering into a tunnel or entering into something. So you focus your mind on the object and you go to a certain stage to go into the mind of calm abiding. And then the ninth stage is called placement with equanimity. So there is no more effort. As soon as you sit down, you're so familiarized with that state of meditation, you just sit down and you're in that state for the whole session. No matter how long, you can stay on the object without any excitement or any dullness. So that's a fantastic state of mind. This is the ninth stage of calm abiding. It's not a fully qualified calm abiding. Then you have to cultivate that for a certain period of time. And then there's something which you cultivate that as a transformation of your body and mind happens. It's a kind of physical bliss which arrives, and a mental bliss. And physical and mental bliss give rise to a special physical suppleness or pliancy or lightness about your body and a lightness about your mind. A sharpness, a suppleness about the mind, a pliancy where you can also apply your mind for anything which you want, whenever you want. The mind has always great enthusiasm. You never lose enthusiasm for doing something. So when this process has happened, physical and mental bliss has arisen, and then the physical suppleness and mental suppleness has arisen, and get stabilized, then this is called calm abiding. It's a very clear path. It's very well put down. Where you are, what's your problem, and how to face it, to go to the next stage. So this you find in the Lamrim tradition, in the section on calm abiding, an explanation in detail on that. So good luck.
Good luck. Yeah.
Mind to sit down. Normally I meditate I wake up, kind of when I'm still kind of stay set, get my frame of mind, like I'll get myself right. It's like, I know that I'm already whole, you know, that I already have everything. It's already here. And, so therefore I can go out in the world and, you know, be good for other people. By meditating, I feel, because of this heightened awareness, that I can almost sense my, if something, you know, my own thoughts, like if I'm having negative thoughts about someone or kind of my own delusions, I can see them, you know, it's like, all right, there's my delusion. And there's like this separation sometimes between the thought and kind of my awareness, watching the thoughts coming, you know, and it's kind of, you know, like, it's like a dream, you know, watching my own hallucination, you know, there's just some sort of space between where I'm not really identifying with everything, how that relates to my morality. It's like keeping a check on my actions, you know, my thoughts, you know, my words. Or if something's happening, I'm not like just, you know, jumping out and saying, reacting with harsh words. If I keep that, you know, like very spacious awareness, you know, it's like, this is all me. Why would I want to have these ugly thoughts or, you know, towards, you know, these kind people around me?
So this perfect meditation involves concentration. And concentration is a very elusive thing, I found. It's very funny because you think that you can just go and you can set the mind, especially in a quiet environment. You're not going to have the outside influences, and you'll be able to get to a very concentrated state very quickly. Well, that may be true at certain times, but I tell you, most of the time the mind is wandering. It takes a lot of determination. It takes a lot of time to be able to control it. I find very much you get a little taste of how things really do exist. And once you get that little taste, you become very hungry. You want to repeat that experience. So meditation is vital for that, because you want to keep bringing the mind back to that little taste you had. You have the fortunate circumstances to receive the Dharma teachings in this life, to meet these precious lamas who are spreading the truth. And we can realize this truth. It's not just for lamas or teachers or long-term meditators. The common everyday person, business person, the housewife, everybody can realize the ultimate nature. And we must do it, because we have this human rebirth. We have a very short time. We have this flash of lightning in order to do it. And we can't waste our lives drowning in alcohol, drowning in drugs. We have to do it with positive actions. We have to use meditation to calm the mind. We have to use meditation to understand the way things really exist, and we have to use meditation to achieve that goal in order to help it. Without meditation, there's no way that you can develop the habit of seeing that everything is a projection. That meditation is vital, it's essential. It's sort of like the water, it's the air in your life.
There's some when I first got introduced to Buddhism, which was over 40 years ago, kind of interesting, but and Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa were my two introductory teachers, but somebody asked Lama Yeshe, they said, well, when do you, because they never saw him hardly sitting down to meditate. He was always laughing. He was like the he just had the greatest sense of humor and just so happy and jovial, you know, like the laughing Buddha. And people said, you know, they never saw him meditating. I said, well, when do you meditate? And he says, he said, I meditate 24/7. It's like, it's, you know, all the time. So, you know, to be able to develop that kind of mind that is meditating all the time, that'd be good, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that be a good thing to do? Yeah. So, what is, here's a trick question. What's the most important time in your meditation practice? No. It's when you get up from the cushion. Seriously. Because otherwise, you know, the point of meditation is not to, is not just to meditate, it's to transform our lives. And if so, what we get from the practice, you know, of sitting, we need to be able to take it out into the world. Now, what Venerable Rene was talking about, this calm abiding, concentration practice, that's a good, and actually it's a good place to start. Even Bhante here in this book, he, even though it's all about mindfulness, you know, and we'll talk about, you know, what, there's different kinds of, you know, the Vipassana meditation, I guess, is what we're, is the main point of the book. But then he says, you really have to get your head, you know, get some degree of concentration going before you'll be successful in your Vipassana practice. So in the beginning, we're going to focus on the breath. We're going to focus on developing, you know, as Renee said, like a laser, a mind that's can stay with the breath, doesn't veer away. And he talked about excitement, you know, where the usually it's based on, we think objects of attachment cause the mind to get a little bit excited, and so off we go chasing mentally after some exciting experience or memory or whatever, something we've done or have done or want to do, or, you know, then we have to like bring the mind back. And then sometimes we get very torporous and the mind gets heavy and dull, right? And so we have to enliven the mind and then and bring that mind back and kind of have it focus on the object of meditation. Any questions about, I wanted to say one thing. So when the Dalai Lama's translator was talking about, and somebody can correct me, but he was saying, well, we already do this every day, but, you know, he was talking about analytical meditation, right, and placement meditation. He said, we're already doing it every day in our ordinary life, but now we're going to take those same skills and turn them towards spiritual practice. That's what I heard. So what do you think he meant by that? We already do it every day. Anybody?
You become familiar with all kinds of different events or functions.
Say it again.
Sorry, we become familiar with all kinds of different events or functionality at our job or typing on a keyboard or whatever thing that we didn't know, but then we become familiar with it. So we can take that same practice and direct those energies towards something positive.
I think I hear what you're saying, but I don't think that's what I heard. You know, anybody else hear anything different? Well, I'll stop playing 21 questions and say, you know, what we do is we see somebody, we're at work and there's something, let's just say there's somebody you don't like. Let's use something negative here. You know, and we think and we analyze them and we start like conjuring up like the 30 reasons that we can't stand their guts, you know, and then we get really, really clear on why they're just the personification of evil, And then our mind, like, okay, then we're so sure that we're right, the mind just stays right there. Right? We fixate on that. Because we've done the analysis, right? We're really clear about it. And then we fixate the mind on that hatred of that particular person. That's our... Now, since it's a negative mind state, the mind will stay there very long. But you can... I mean, you know, we've done this with things that we're attached to. You know, pleasurable experiences. Oh, my gosh. You know, or people that we're attached to. We embellish their good qualities. We do analytical meditation on how great they are, right? And then we as soon as we're clear that they are that good, we reach a conclusion, and then bam, we just, our mind just stays focused right on that person, and deepens the attachment to that particular person. So he said, at least that's what I heard, that we're already using those different qualities of mind, of analysis and placement. But here we're using it in spiritual practice. So for example, if you're going to meditate on like the precious human rebirth, did Robbie do that one? Probably not. Pardon? But anyway, it was mentioned in the video, but it's like when we think about how really short our life is. I mean, there are young people in here, right? There are old people in here. There's people in between, you know. But hey, there's no guarantee. In fact, right before I got here tonight, I get these little things from Lama's Open. It pops up on my thing. And it was something like, you could die at any moment. Don't waste a second not doing spiritual practice, not transforming your mind into the Dharma. Important to recognize that. Life is precious. You know, we don't have a lot of time. You think young people die before old people, right? Sometimes the young die before the old. You know, we just don't know. So we do know one thing, that for those of you who have some faith, you come into contact with an opportunity to learn a method that can actually save your life in the real sense of giving you a quality of life you never even realized was possible. Because our mind controls our experience, doesn't it? You cannot have enough stuff, can't have enough pleasurable experiences. It's not going to happen. I got an audio here, but I don't know if I'm going to have time to do it or not. Did anybody hear anything else in that video that they wanted to talk about? Yes or no? This is a quiet crowd.
They'll warm up. And just a reminder, we use the microphone since we're streaming, so thanks for talking into it.
I'm going to write while you talk. Go ahead.
Okay, I just had a question about what the teacher meant about everything is projection. I instantly went to like the Matrix, and I'm not sure what to do. I don't know what that means in terms of Buddhism and meditation.
Great question. There's a whole class on that, actually, a whole module. It's on emptiness. Here's a quick version of it. Lama Yeshe said, basically, our mind is like doing a glorified paint job on reality. Right? Our mind is projecting a reality. And where does that reality come from? It comes from our mind. Where does the mind get the paint to project, to paint this reality that we're seeing? From our former actions. From our former actions. And so what we do is we project a reality, a solid, we believe, it's the truth, it's the way it is. And we solidify it, and we believe in it, and react to it. So if we see somebody we hate, you know, we want to harm them. Well, somebody that we're attracted to, we want to own them, we want to possess them, and things like that. So the mind has this amazing ability to project our reality, and we believe it. It's not so bad to, if we recognize that we're projecting and don't believe it, like the monk was saying, like a dream, like seeing it as a dream, not getting hooked by the projections. And that's a big part of what we'll talk about in this class, about in Vipassana meditation, but that has to do with emptiness. Okay, so pleasure, pain, this is one of my favorite subjects, gain, loss. This is going to be, you know, this is our mind, basically, you know, 99.9% of the time. Praise and blame. Sometimes I like to write approval because everybody understands what approval is. Please like me. Please like me. Don't, you know, if you don't like me, I'm going to die. Praise and blame. Disapproval. Okay. So, what I'm saying here is that there's this great Buddhist monk that I met. By the way, I'm not claiming to be a great meditator. I think I made it clear in the last class. I'm an advanced beginner, so that's really true. But I have been exposed to some great teachers and had some nice experiences over the years. And I was in Thailand back in the mid-80s, and there was this wonderful, wonderful monk named Achin Buddhadasa. And I remember I wrote it in my notes. He said, we're addicted to deliciousness. Now, what I'm getting ready to say, we can revisit this many, many times, but normally in life, what do we want? If you had to come into broad categories of things that we crave, these are the delicious things, aren't they? The pleasurable experiences, having stuff, having a good reputation and being thought well of, and then people saying nice things about us and giving us a lot of approval. So we crave and cling to getting these experiences. Anybody got a problem? Anybody want to debate this point? Is this clear? Do you believe it? Does anybody have a problem? Is there any question about it? No, there's no doubt about it. And at the same time, what else do we crave? To not have this pain, loss, disgrace, and blame. We cling to that. That's the flip side of this coin. The more you crave pleasure, the more you suffer. The more you crave that relationship, right? We'll call it gain. When it dissolves, the more you suffer, right? So again, you can see, and so there's, now, is this all of these things are part of life, though, right? They're all part of life. We're going to have pleasure. We're going to get stuff, all of these things, but we're going to have pain and loss and all of this. And if we cling to this and we cling to not having this, which is another way of saying we fear it. We fear these things. And it's happening. It's the flip side of the same coin. It's happening as we crave pleasure. Simultaneously, we're fearing pain and we don't recognize it. But it's part of our mental, our inner world. Okay? And so, we as soon as we have these things, we cling to these pleasures because they also give us pleasurable experiences, or we call them pleasant feelings, right? And then these things give us feelings of aversion. So we have aversion to this, and we cling to this. So all of this is created by this addiction to deliciousness. The mind clings to this and clings to not having these things. Now, what's the remedy? How do we fix this?
Mindfulness.
Pardon?
Mindfulness.
Mindfulness is good, but what about it?
Acceptance.
I'm sorry?
Acceptance.
Accepting? Okay, say more.
Embracing the things that make you uncomfortable.
Pardon?
Embracing the things that make you uncomfortable.
How do you do that? How do you embrace things that make you uncomfortable? You want to give him the thing? How do you embrace things that make you uncomfortable? Oh. That's what we're going to try to figure out together, yeah.
By not trying to qualify something as positive or negative and just saying it is and accepting what it is.
It'd be nice if we could do that. But, you know, when that dentist is hitting the nerve root on that third molar, you can't call that pleasant. I don't care how good you are. You know, that goes, ow, that hurts. That's painful. So here's the deal. Pardon?
Impermanent.
There you go. It's impermanent. None of this stuff lasts. So we have to learn how to, we have to recognize that the nature of our existence is impermanent, that pleasant things don't last and pain doesn't last. None of these things last. And so because we're aware that they're impermanent, we can let go. We have to learn how to let go. That's the remedy to clinging. Letting go, right? Clinging, letting go. I used to have something... I'm going to run out of time again. I do it every time. Anyway, I used to have at the old center, I made a piece of plastic. What do you call that? Thick plastic, anyway. It was see-through stuff. And I had a hole cut in it. And I'd heard this story about monkeys in some place where they would... Where the way they trapped the monkeys would, they would put a banana in a coconut, a little bitty hole, where the monkeys could reach into the banana, into the coconut, grab the banana, and then you could catch the monkey, because he wouldn't turn loose of the banana. He wouldn't let go. Isn't that crazy? So, you know, I used to bring that thing to class, and I'd say, you know, we'd practice putting our hand through there. And it's a powerful image, though. It's just all the monkey had to do to survive was let go. All we have to do to survive is to not cling, is to see that everything is impermanent. When I was in Thailand that same trip, but at a different place, I met a monk who was actually Japanese, but he was living he was a Theravada monk, and he had just finished like a 3-year retreat by himself in what they call a kuti, Anybody been to Thailand and seen these things on stilts? These little rooms, they're not big. The bathrooms are downstairs. And he couldn't even see out. They had to put a tent over this thing, so the air could come in, but he had just lived for 3 years, basically sensory deprivation for 3 years. And very powerful meditator. And I asked him, I said, beneficial or important thing that you learned? And he said impermanence. Okay. And he was not talking about gross impermanence, probably. I mean, his body did decay a little bit, but his health may have gotten worse. But he was talking about the subtle impermanence that goes on in our mind moment to moment to moment. So when you're angry and you focus on the anger, what happens? You notice anger. Next time tomorrow when you get upset or irritated or bored, just boredom. We got plenty of boredom. Next time you get bored, just go notice boredom. Bored. Mentally note it. Experience boredom. Really get into the experience of boredom. Bored. And it will go away. It will disappear. And then you're in this, you can come back to your breath, right? And you'll be going through your life. And if you can remember to come back to your breath, it's always cool. Come back to your breath. Then anger arises in the mind, or irritation. Somebody's pulled in front of you, and you're annoyed. And you go, annoyed. Mentally, you go, I'm annoyed. And you kind of open to the experience of being annoyed and notice that it changes and then eventually disappears. And you let go. So that was what he learned, was impermanence. So that's that's kind of the big take-home message tonight. So I had a 15-minute audio presentation all teed up tonight, but you're going to have to read it in chapter one here of this book. But you don't have the book, so you'll have to maybe wait till next week.
Don, supposedly the book is coming in this week.
Okay,
so
good.
If you're back in the center this week sometime, look for it.
Right. Yeah, so this kind of tells you how far back. I told you I'm not a spring chicken. This was published in 1984, the first edition of How to Meditate, and obviously it's morphed. I think Kathleen has added quite a bit to it, but looks a lot different than it did back then. So I want people to go ahead and start doing some reading. And let's see. I'm giving you your homework right now, by the way. So let's get through through page 27, establishing meditation practice and so forth. That's pretty easy. And then when the other book comes in, we'll do that. Any questions so far? Pardon? Yeah, just the first section of the book on how to meditate.
And that book is available in the bookstore.
Yeah.
Right. Tonight.
Okay, so I tell you, I haven't done this in years, what I'm getting ready to, ask you people to do. However, when I took my first meditation course at Kopan Monastery in Nepal back in 1978, and they told me that Karen, she still lives there. She was a She was this beautiful Swedish nun who was about like 25 years old. And I just couldn't figure out why such a beautiful young woman would shave her head and wear and become a nun. I was very sort of taken by the fact that she had made that commitment. But she said, look, if you want to do this one-month retreat, which I signed up for, she said, you have to be here the whole time. Have 100% participation. You have to come to every lecture, and you have to do all the meditations. And you have to be 100% in. And if you're not, just that's fine. Just go back down into Kathmandu and have some fun. And then you can come back. There's shorter courses, there's 1 week courses, but this is a 1 month course. So the very first time I taught a Lam Rim course, I have to say this. Robbie Watkins was in it. He and I were doing our residency together. We're both physicians, and we were at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. And I had told him I was doing this class, and I was going to read my notes because I didn't know what I was talking about to begin with. But I'd been to Copan, and I'd taken great notes, and I was just going to read my notes. And I was doing it through the UAB Evening Extension Service, University of Alabama, Birmingham. And I told Robbie about it. I was just in passing, and he said, I'd be interested. And I was kind of shocked, because I wasn't trying to encourage him to do it, but he came. And when we got there, there were 12 people there, and I said, and at some point I said, okay, so if you're 100% committed, and you're going to come every class, you're going to do the homework, okay? You can cut every class in its entirety, do the homework, and do the meditations. Please stand up. And if you're not going to do it, then please pick another course. Come back another time. You can stream it online at home. It's happening at home. You can do it. You don't have to be here. But really what I'd like to see is... And I'm not going to, you know, look at all the name tags and say, what is this person doing here? Or that so-and-so didn't show up. But I'm asking, if you're willing to be 100% committed, because that's the only way you're going to get any benefit, by the way. If you're not 100% committed, you're almost better off staying at home. Because you're going to get little to nothing out of this class if you do not put effort, a lot of effort into it, because this is hard work. You cannot believe how meditation, as Monte says, it takes gumption. It takes effort. So if you're willing to do that, please stand up. 100% committed, lead all the classes, do all the meditations, all the practice. If you can't do it, and you can't come, it's okay. I'm not passing any judgment here. If you can't stand up too, it's okay. Raise your hand. Okay. All right. So thank you for making the commitment. So now I know who will be here and who to look for. All right. So, and those of you who can't make it, there, you know, every 2 years How to Meditate comes back around, but you can stream it at home, and there are lots. You can use this book; it's a great book to use if you don't have a teacher. There are lots of different ways to, lots of places and ways to learn about meditation, but it is a lot easier to do it with other people, to practice with others. It makes a big difference. Okay. So when you do your practice at home, I suggest that you get a quiet place and you set your motivation. Then you check your posture, okay? Then we're going to just use the breath. So you just follow the breath And you do that. I recommend 10 minutes and then add 5 minutes to it. So whatever time you pick, add 5 minutes to it if you can. So try to do 15 minutes once a day. The easiest time is in the morning because the mind is less active, but you can do it in the evening as well. But, you know, do it 15 minutes a day of formal meditation practice. And then at the end of the practice, then you dedicate. So one of the, did Robbie read the dedication verses? Let's do that. Let's read the dedication verses. Let's save the questions to the end because we're running over. I don't want to do...
It's page 32.
32? Okay. Actually, I like the Shanti Deva's dedication. It's really sweet. Kind of universal. Oh, yeah, on 246. Let's
246.
Do that one. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are born with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing and the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, then may I remain to dispel the miseries of the world. So thank you for showing up. Now, one last thing I'd like for you to do, because this is, like I said, this is not easy. So I'd like for you to find one other person, at least. It could be two. That's going to be, those of you who are going to be coming, that is going to be like your buddy. And I'd like for you to exchange, somebody you feel comfortable, you know, exchanging phone numbers with. And I'd like for y'all to talk at least once, if not more during the week, about whatever obstacles are coming up, what your experience is, whatever's going on. I'd like for you to talk to your buddy at least once, if not more, during the week. Between now and next week. And then bring any questions you have if something comes up too. So is everybody who stood up willing to do the buddy system? Raise your hand, please, thank you. All right, so just do that now before you leave today. Get your buddy, exchange your phone numbers. We'll start promptly at 7 o'clock next week. Thank you.